From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. The writer Seth Graham Smith made a name for himself when he mashed up a zombie apocalypse story and a Jane Austen novel. And that made English lit purists wonder, is nothing sacred? Well, Graham returned the next year with Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. It's an inventive take on the undead and on some of the most hallowed and shameful parts of the American story. The book was a bestseller, and a movie of the same name opened last week with pretty good ticket sales. But historian Scott Poole isn't crying foul. He says that Americans have long used vampires and other monsters as a way to deal with and understand our changing society, our national fears, and even our history. Vampires in America, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Matthew LaPlante, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Well, in spite of some pretty negative reviews and a plot that may be historically repulsive to some and just plain repulsive to others, the movie Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, had a pretty respectable opening weekend last week. The film is an adaptation of Seth Graham Greene's book of the same name, which was notably better received and a New York Times bestseller. It's also just the latest in a series of vampire tales that have captivated audiences in recent years. There's Buffy and Twilight and True Blood. Americans just can't seem to get enough bloodsuckers. Well, historian Scott Poole says there's good reason for that, and it's not just that vampires make good stock characters. Vampires, he says, are a reaction to our changing society, our national fears, and our complicated relationship with our history. Scott Poole is the author of 6 books. The most recent is called Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. He's used the book Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter as a text in his classes at the College of Charleston, where he's an associate professor of history. He's joining us today from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina. Scott Poole, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Matthew. I always like the opportunity to talk about monsters, so I appreciate this.
Well, that's good. You'll have that opportunity today. You know, a lot of kids grow up watching monster movies, but not many of them wind up making a career out of monster scholarship. And very few people look so deep into the historical roots of American monsters as you have. So I'm wondering where that interest first came from.
Well, you're absolutely right that monster scholarship is not a terribly crowded field. So I guess maybe I saw sort of an opportunity there. It does come out of my own personal interests. I always really like to make it clear that, you know, I'm a historian who studies monsters, but I'm also a monster nerd and a horror nerd and kind of always have been. Actually grew up in the 70s on a pretty steady diet of shock theater and the old Universal classic monsters, and then really got into the slasher films in the 80s. So I came at this as a fan, but also more than a fan. I really wanted to use my research and my background as a historian to think about how to access some parts of American history that maybe there's not another way to do it. One of the things that I discovered and really kept coming across as I looked at a lot of different eras in American history is that monster stories have been essential to us at almost every critical juncture in the development of the United States. They've been a way for us to talk to ourselves about our anxieties about a whole variety of social and political and religious topics. So, you know, while I'm definitely scholar first, I'm geek second. And the kind of things that I like to examine and talk about, I'd really like for scholars to be interested in. I'd really like for fans of the genre to think about the stuff that they love in a different way as well.
Your book covers a spectrum of monsters, sea serpents and serial killers, but there are two that you've set aside, I think, as different or special in some very specific and maybe quite American ways. What makes zombies and vampires different? What makes them so uniquely American?
Well, you know, I mean, the vampire, is an immigrant to the United States. I mean, it's sort of like just like Dracula made his way from Transylvania to London. Vampires are an import from the old world. We, however, gave them a particular kind of spin, beginning really in the 1930s with Bela Lugosi's Dracula. I think zombies are actually even a little bit more interesting along those lines. I think they are true American originals, in the sense that while they're borrowed to some degree from Caribbean mythology, specifically Haitian Valdun, and the first zombies in American cinema in the 1930s and the 1940s were what are sometimes simply called Caribbean zombies, Haitian zombies. They were undead, but they were these undead that were under the control of Papalawos, the control of Valdun medicine men. That changed in the 1960s, and George Romero's zombies that appeared in the 1968 Night of the Living Dead were really a different monster entirely, a different creature entirely. Hordes of undead bringing about an apocalypse, and I think that's one of the things that has made the zombie in particular especially interesting to American audiences. They rose to popularity at the same time that there was this consequent interest in the apocalypse. And the possibility of the end of the world beginning in the 1970s, really all the way on up to the present. So, these are very different creatures, very different monsters. They have different kinds of folklore, but they're also kind of these evil twins. They're both about immortality. They're both about death at one and the same time.
You mentioned the evil twin conception. I suppose Frankenstein's right. monster in some ways is a zombie of sorts. I don't think a lot of people knew this. I certainly didn't know this before reading your book, that two of the most famous monster archetypes, the evil twins, as I think they're generally called, Frankenstein's monster and the modern iteration of the vampire, were born during the same Swiss holiday in 1816. Can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, actually, it was a weekend that featured, sort of the greatest hits of the Romantic era: Lord Byron, Percy Shelley, and Mary Godwin, later known as Mary Shelley, and as well as Lord Byron's sort of personal physician and friend John Polidori. One of the interesting things about that happened on that weekend is that they Lord Byron actually suggested a kind of a contest in which each member of the group would write a ghost story, write and tell a ghost story. And Mary Godwin, who at the time was, I believe, about 17, maybe 18 years old, her contribution to that was at least an early draft of Frankenstein. At the same time, John Polidori, who's not a name that's immediately recognizable today, I don't think, he essentially created a vampire story that became sort of the paradigm for a lot of 19th century vampire stories, including the most famous Bram Stoker's Dracula in the 1890s. You have kind of this one particular moment, sort of these Gothic romanticists getting together, creating these creatures that would become really symbolic of so much over the next 200 years. I think Frankenstein, maybe more than Dracula, you could make a pretty good argument that Frankenstein has almost become the metaphor for modernity and for kind of the terrors of modernity. But both of them had their beginnings in, at least for Western culture, Western European and eventually American culture, on that very strange weekend.
Those two characters, the Frankenstein's monster and the vampire, ultimately arrive in the United States and grow in population. In popularity, but they grow in very different ways and at very different times, correct?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I would say that, the vampire has almost no popularity at all in the United States during the 19th century and really didn't until the early 20th century. Frankenstein's monster had enormous popularity almost immediately. And in fact, by the 1820s, the story of Frankenstein would have been relatively well known to most Americans. They would have encountered it probably as a play. It actually traveled as a dramatic presentation Various companies would perform versions of Frankenstein, traveling into little rural towns all across the United States and urban areas. And so even more than the novel, it really had a tremendous effect on the tradition of American horror. And in interesting ways in American politics, one of the most interesting things that I came across about the story of Frankenstein is that the 1840s and the 1850s, the same period when, you know, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter is getting active, the story of Frankenstein was actually became a kind of a metaphor both for Southern slaveholders and for abolitionists to talk about either what they adored about the institution of slavery or what they despised. And this continued on into the Civil War itself. Charles Sumner, the famous abolitionist senator from Massachusetts, who was actually a friend of Mary Shelley's, made a comparison between Frankenstein's monster and the Confederacy. This sort of idea that when the Southern states seceded from the Union, they had become these sort of dead corpses or parts of a dead corpse, and they'd been reassembled into this terrible monster, the Confederate States of America. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, I have, you know, not so much problem with Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. These ideas have been of sort of the supernatural evil as being at the roots of American political and social events have been with us a really long time, and people were doing it all the way back in the 19th century.
Let's move forward just a little bit in time. Toward the beginning of your book, you write about the Depression-era Todd Browning film Freaks, which is a fictional story, but the cast is made up of real circus sideshow performers. I think there's Siamese twins and a boy that looks like a cat. And Americans really didn't like this movie very much.
Some didn't. They hated the movie. And, in fact, they were literally sickened by the movie. And by that, I mean at some of the early showings in, I believe, 1933. I mean, you had people becoming physically ill in the theater, literally running out of the theater. The only thing sort of similar to it, actually, is some of the reactions to The Exorcist that you read about from the early 70s. So yes, that was a despised movie.
But this film, it flops at almost the same time in American history as Americans are falling in love with another Browning film, Dracula. I'm wondering, why does Browning's Dracula succeed where Freaks failed?
You know, that was actually one of the questions that interested me a lot about the 1930s and became a way for me, I think, to think about how Americans think about monsters and horror in general. You're right. I mean, Dracula was a film that really made Universal Studios in the 1930s, or at least sort of remade them. Their monster movies, Frankenstein, The Bride of Frankenstein, eventually The Wolfman in the 1940s, really kept Universal alive during that period. Now, Freaks did not have that same effect for MGM, and in fact, they were so embarrassed by the film that they actually sold it away. They really didn't want to have anything to do with it at all. My sense of what happened is that Americans were okay with monsters. It wasn't the monstrous, it wasn't the horrific that frightened them. But they did want the monster to be seen as the other, as the different, as something that the angry villagers could go out and take care of. That's not the story that Browning told in Freaks. One of the things that's so interesting about Freaks is that it's ultimately the story of a group of sideshow performers' revenge on some normals who had done some horrible things to one of their own. And so it was as if the abnormal was kind of unwilling to become the object of America's gaze. They were gonna stare back. And you know, I think one thing that almost interests me more than the popularity of the classic Universal monsters at the same time that Freaks was so disdained is that, I mean, Americans were attending actual freak shows in the 1930s. They remained very popular into kind of the post-World War II period. So it wasn't really sort of the sideshow itself that was so problematic. It was the fact that Freak sort of called into question where we draw the line between the normal and abnormal. And it's kind of my sense that the best monster stories always do that.
So then we have Dracula.
Yes.
And you fast forward through the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. We're talking about a period that includes several wars, the civil rights movement, the moon landing, Watergate, Roe
right.
versus Wade. And throughout all
right.
of that, Dracula is still a thing. So much so that,
yes.
as I understand it, you dressed up as him for Halloween in 1978.
I did do that, yeah. I'd probably do it next year, in fact. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, Dracula has been with us since 1931 and even before. I mentioned Frankenstein's popularity as a traveling dramatic performance in the 19th century. The same thing happens with Bram Stoker's Dracula. So actually, even before Bela Lugosi did Dracula in 31, a lot of Americans would have been familiar with that story. And then, you know, he gets a real resurgence in the late 1950s when the Hammer horror films start making their way over from Britain, Britain's Hammer Studios.
These are the Christopher Lee
Christopher
films.
Christopher Lee. Yeah, these are the Christopher Lee films. Exactly. The horror of Dracula was the first one. At least that's how it was marketed in the United States, and has had a number of cinema reiterations since. I mean, of course, Frank Langella does Dracula for the 1970s, kind of sexes up Dracula even more than Christopher Lee did, even more than Bela Lugosi did. And then, you know, in the 90s, you get, you know, this really beautiful, very stylistic film, Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. So he's a figure that it's been difficult to get away from. I think that there is something about Dracula as aristocrat and representative of sort of the old world that America is not and has always defined itself over against, that it just makes him a sort of a perennial fascination for Americans. I will say that, you know, there have been time periods in which his popularity has waned. You know, after Bela Lugosi's Dracula, Bela Lugosi's career kind of goes downhill. I mean, most people know the story about him starring in Ed Wood movies and that kind of thing in the late 50s. But also Dracula sort of goes into decline, and it really took Christopher Lee to bring him back. And I will say, too, that it interests me very much that I will say that in maybe the last decade, decade and a half, while vampires have been so popular, Dracula himself has been largely absent from that cultural fascination.
That's Scott Poole. He's an assistant professor of history at the College of Charleston and the author of Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. You can learn more about the book at monstersinamerica.com. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Matthew LaPlante filling in for Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about the American relationship and a seeming obsession with vampires. With us is Scott Poole. He is the author of Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. And he recently wrote a piece for the Huffington Post arguing that historians can learn a lot from America's long love affair with vampires. Scott Poole, what do you think has changed about vampires and the American relationship with vampires in the modern era, maybe starting with Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles?
Sure. Yeah, a lot has changed. And I think probably the biggest transformation of vampire narratives in America has had to do with the introduction of what you might call the vampire with the tormented soul, the vampire who is, in a certain sense, a kind of a slave to his or her own appetites, but also has sort of these transcendent feelings that make them fall in love. And this has been something that's been explored really by Anne Rice first. I mean, she sort of created, in a way, the brooding, tormented vampire. I mean, Bela Lugosi's Dracula, Christopher Lee's Dracula, they had been one step away from just sort of ravening monsters. But Rice, in certain ways, sort of humanizes them, gives them romantic feelings, and introduces romantic elements into the story, so much so that I mentioned Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula a few moments ago, and that is as much a sort of a strange kind of love story as it is anything else. And so I would say that has been the biggest change, sort of giving vampires a dating life, a romantic life.
It seems that maybe we've moved into this new period of vampire obsession, and maybe the period of greatest obsession in the sense that hundreds of millions of people are reading Twilight, and they're not just doing mm-hmm. that, but they're engaged in endless blogging and Facebooking about it. And
right.
I was on a date once, and I saw a guy with his wife or his girlfriend, and he was wearing a shirt that said, "I'm her Edward."
Right.
True Blood is one of the hottest shows on HBO. This is a network known for churning out hot shows. What's going on in our history right now that's making this just so attractive to people?
I think that there's actually two things that help explain the significance of vampires and our obsession with them. First, I would say that this is part of a much longer trajectory, that we're just kind of in the middle of this kind of white hot intense version of. If you go all the way back to the 70s, you have kind of the rise of the significance of vampires and zombies as well. And I actually think that has something to do with the post-Vietnam era. The fact that, as we all know, Vietnam is often thought of as the first living room war. Part of what that meant was that Americans were sort of forced over a period of a number of years to confront mortality, to confront the destruction of the human body, to see dismemberment on the evening news, and also to experience that in their own lives. If they were vets, friends of vets, families of vets, this became a real time in American culture where we came face to face, whether we wanted to or not, with the reality of mortality. I think that there's something that happened that's maybe partially a consequence of that, although this is, I think, a complex topic. You know, in the 1980s, which is with the Rice novels, this real kind of launching pad for vampire obsessions, we were right in the middle of the plastic surgery revolution. Now, this was not plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery was not brand new. However, the idea of plastic surgery primarily for aesthetic reasons, and that people at every level of society could take part in and benefit from, this became a real part of American culture. It's a time period, for example, in which plastic surgeons started to become sort of celebrities and started appearing on talk shows and having books, almost kind of the beginning of the nip-tuck phenomenon in a way. And so that actually suggests to me that at the end of the 20th century, Americans found themselves very uncomfortable in their own skins in a literal kind of way. Here you have this monster, the vampire, who is, at least in the most modern iterations, is this example of perpetual beauty, a kind of glamorous post-mortem experience. All of the fears of what could happen to our bodies, what in fact is happening to our bodies every single day, they're declining, they're beginning the descent into death. But the vampire becomes this almost totemistic representation of transcending all of that. I would have to throw in too that the other side of this, our fascination with the zombie, is sort of the opposite of that dream. It's sort of the American nightmare when it comes to our bodily obsessions. I mean, the zombie is obviously not perpetually beautiful. In fact, quite the opposite. I mean, the zombie is rotting away and is almost sort of the antithesis of American dieting culture as well. I mean, you know, a zombie is just an eating machine, essentially, that at the same time, you know, is rotting and becoming dismembered. And so, you know, a lot of these concerns are mixed up together in this particular historical moment. And in the last decade, which, you know, is a period where we also saw a gigantic, and I mean a gigantic increase in the use of cosmetic surgery, fascination with dieting culture, etc. This is the same period in which the vampire and the zombie have really become intense obsessions.
Do you think that it's any coincidence that the renewal of the vampire as a pop cultural phenomenon in the early part of this century comes as HIV/AIDS, a disease culturally aligned with our ideas about sex and blood, has been moved from a disease that was once considered to be rapidly terminal to one that's now understood to be chronic and manageable?
Yeah, I find that to be especially interesting given that one of the most frightening things, sort of one of the real world horrors that I investigated in my research, is the way that that many, particularly on the political right during the 1980s, actually used monster imagery to talk about AIDS and also about people living with AIDS. You had, for example, in the late 70s, Anita Bryant making use of essentially vampire imagery to talk about gay men. I mean, she described them as almost these supernatural menaces who only went out at night and they were recruiting to replenish their numbers. And all this sort of imagery of something that was transmittable, that got blended in the 1980s into the imagery of contagion. So that actually has a particularly dark history, I think, in sort of the history of political rhetoric and the history of the representation of people. One of the things that, you know, I think is the real dark side of a lot of this discussion is that as much fun as monster stories always are, the fact of the matter is, in our politics and in our cultural reflections on society, we frequently turn other people into monsters. We turn social movements into monsters. Certainly like that happened with AIDS.
When we were talking about freaks earlier, you mentioned this, the fear of the other, the fear of the different, mm-hmm. and that certainly plays into what you've been talking about.
Right.
What is that still part of the – I mean, I'm sure it's still part of the fear, but is that still the driving part of the fear? How much of monsterdom is now fear of others versus maybe fear of something else, fear of something inside of us?
Well, I think, you know, one of the positive things that I would say about really kind of all kinds of monster narratives that have appeared over the last decade or so is that more and more the idea of the monster as being sympathetic or the monster as being complicated and being nuanced has really come to the fore. One of the things that I loved about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, this critically acclaimed show from the late 90s, early part of this century, is that, you know, it really imagined that monsters were more than simply monsters. They were not just kind of a demonic other. Part of the trajectory of that story is learning to live with one's own monsters and also learning to live with literal monsters. The group of friends that surrounds Buffy in that TV show really create kind of this odd kind of community that includes everybody from, well, of course, a vampire slayer to a witch to a centuries-old demon to a werewolf. And it's sort of this notion that, you know, let's actually use this idea of the monster slayer, but then let's call into question the idea of monster slaying. The idea that the angry villagers with torches is the only possible response to to the monstrous. I don't know that they are always best understood as kind of responses to our own inner states or our own anxieties. Part of the reason that I think that is that, you know, time and time again, as I've looked at monster narratives going all the way back to the colonial period, I found ways in which they've been, monster narratives have sort of been hardwired into real world American events, whether we're talking about, you know, zombies and the Vietnam War or the 19th century obsession with sea serpents and the professionalization of science, you know, fears of radiation and the atomic bomb tied into notions about flying saucers in the 1940s and 1950s. So I'm always a little bit leery of seeing monsters as, you know, these kind of Jungian archetypes, these sort of representations of our inner states. I think that they sometimes play a role like that, particularly in our dream life. But I'm really interested in sort of our cultural dream life and what that says about us at different moments in our history.
I have an email from Jeremiah in Salt Lake City. He's asking about the character Barnabas Collins, a character from Jonathan Freed's gothic soap drama Dark Shadows.
Yeah.
And he's wondering about, and this plays in very well to what we're talking about right now, how that character relates to the development of the vampire as a deeper soul. He says, as a tormented soul who apologizes for being a monster. Was that the first right. reckoning of that kind of or the first imagining as of the vampire as something deeper than just a monster?
You know, I think to some degree, I don't know that it's even the absolute first. Even in Bela Lugosi, there's actually a couple of moments in Todd Browning's Dracula where we're encouraged to have some degree of sympathy for the monster. I think Barnabas Collins and the Dark Shadows phenomenon, I'm not sure that has had an enormous cult following. But it's been a very sort of underground kind of cult following and not one that has had a lot of effect on vampire mythology sort of more generally. Although he certainly is a sympathetic monster and came along, you know, at a time when there was increasing interest in using monsters to kind of satire and if not satire, at least comment on certain elements in American family life. I mean, in a way, I think that the Addams Family is kind of this really, really quirky version of, you know, the monster soap opera that was Dark Shadows. This idea that, you know, and it comes at the beginning of a period in which anxieties, fears about the changing American family were really at the forefront of a lot of people's minds in the aftermath of the sexual revolution and demographic changes related to real families. So I think the Barnabas Collins and Dark Shadows phenomenon is maybe a little bit more important along in those kind of ways rather than as part of the vampire mythos.
One of the most sympathetic portrayals of vampires and also one that has a huge following is the Twilight Saga. And
yes.
It doesn't seem like you're a big fan. You write that the series will likely make no enduring mark on the American monster tradition. Seems a pretty bold statement about a series that sold more than 100 million copies. I'm wondering how that series deviates from the vampire tradition and why you don't think those deviations will have enduring ripples.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I certainly don't call into question the popularity of Twilight. I mean, and in fact, I also say in the book that I suspect that Twilight in various forms is going to be with us for a while. At the same time, I don't know that it really has very much to do with vampires. And what I mean by that is that Stephanie Myers really sort of reworked the mythos in a pretty radical way. You know, she literally sort of defanged the mythos. I mean, her vampires do not have fangs. And, you know, every new retelling of vampire stories plays with the mythology in different ways. I mean, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter does that. I mean, the vampires get to walk around in sunlight and that kind of thing. They don't sparkle like they do in Twilight, which I was glad to see. But you know, you change the mythos. That happens. What seems to have happened, though, with Meyer in Twilight is she's really just kind of, you know, to use a pretty visceral metaphor, she's just kind of ripped the guts out of the vampire mythology. The fangs are gone, but it's more than that. The sex is gone. And, you know, Alan Ball, actually, the creator of True Blood, made a comment about this to Rolling Stone a couple of years ago. He said, you know, essentially vampires are sex. And I just don't really get a vampire story that is about abstinence. And a number of critics have pointed out that the Twilight series actually comes at the vampire ethos or mythos as kind of a tale of the struggle for family values. Christina Seifert, feminist scholar, coined the term abstinence porn, actually, to describe Twilight, to talk about how Bella, in her relationship with Edward, really sort of becomes this this figure who is very, very restricted, who's restricted in her desires, sort of forced to be restricted in her desires. And just as a historian, at least, I see Twilight as kind of an outgrowth of the culture wars, an outgrowth of the struggle that really begins in the 1970s with the rise of the religious right over a number of different cultural issues, many of them related to women's rights, many of them related to sexuality. So I almost think that the twin popularity of True Blood and Twilight at the same time is maybe a kind of a symbol of where we are as a nation as far as the culture wars. I think that the two different groups who are fans of those franchises often tend to come from two very different places in their own views of what the sexual revolution means, what the heritage of the 60s is, how to deal with the changing nature of marriage. So I think Twilight's an extremely interesting document to explore and important to fit into this discussion. However, I think that it is pretty heavily loaded ideologically, and it's important for readers, I think, to be aware of that.
That's Scott Poole. He's the author of Monsters in America. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Matthew LaPlante filling in for Doug Fabrizio. We're talking today about vampires, and joining us is Scott Poole. He's an associate professor of history at the College of Charleston. We have on the line Mark from Salt Lake City. Mark, go ahead.
Hey there. Hey, Scott. Hey, Matthew. So as I was listening to your program this morning, I was reminded of an article that I read in a BYU Studies journal that's titled The Mormon as Vampire. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But you talk about the other, you know, the monsters have this, you know, this power because they're this other, maybe a disowned part of us. But In the early, I guess it was early 1900s, kind of part of this anti-Mormon movement in Britain, there was a book published by Winifred Graham called The Love Story of a Mormon in 1911. Then it was put into a movie called Trapped by the Mormons, and that was in the early 20s. And the interesting part of this is they portrayed this Mormon missionary, I guess his name is Isolde Keen, it portrayed him almost as a vampire. And he had this power of hypnotic, you know, mesmerizing his victims. And there's one quote from the movie that said, he is underneath the window of this fair maiden, and he says, I had need of you, so I summoned you forth as night summons the stars.
So let's take it from there. Scott Poole, this is the vampire's long been a symbol for the things we fear, the things that we don't understand, right?
Right. Absolutely. And I had not heard that story before. That's absolutely fascinating. Not terribly shocking, in part because there has been a tradition in America that has shown itself in anti-immigrant movements, in nativist movements, in prejudices of various kinds, that has tended to tell essentially gothic stories about these groups or these movements that are seen as fearful, exotic, too different. What it automatically makes me think of, in fact, is nativism in the 19th century that tended to be directed against Roman Catholics. And essentially sort of taking elements of the Gothic novel, which, as I mentioned earlier, you know, through Lord Byron, really had a big influence on the vampire idea, and applying that to these other groups, suggesting that, you know, there were these sort of conspiratorial movements that were right under the surface in America. And as I mentioned as well, I mean, Anita Bryant did a very similar thing with gay and lesbian people in the 70s and 80s. So this is the... you know, it is something that I have to spend a lot of time on in the book, somewhat unfortunately. I mean, I love monsters. I love monster movies. But unfortunately, too often we've used monsters to transform our enemies into something that is sort of beyond the ken and beyond the pale.
In the last part of the time we have left, I'd like to move into a discussion about the movie and the book, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
Sure.
There's arguably nobody as sacred to the American narrative as Abe Lincoln. And there's almost inarguably no shame as deep as slavery.
Right.
You're a monster scholar, but you're also a historian and a Southerner to boot. So what do you make of the fictionalization of the conditions that created and preserved and defended slavery in America?
Well, you know, I read the novel a number of years ago, and as you mentioned at the top of the hour, I have used it with my students before. And part of the reason that I did that is that one of Seth Graham Smith's real achievements in the book, and the book is very different from the movie along these lines and in a lot of other ways, is that, you know, he blended primary sources from the 19th century, the actual words of Lincoln, not the Journal of Abraham Lincoln, as the book purports to be, because we don't have anything like that. But we do have lots of correspondence and lots of speeches. And, you know, one of the really striking things is, you know, he's taking real primary sources, he's repurposing them, and even as he's creating a kind of alternate history, getting the facts, quote unquote, wrong, he did, I think, in the book, maybe manage to dip into the meaning of 19th century history in some interesting ways. For example, it is true that Lincoln, as well as the abolitionist movement, as well as many Northerners who were simply nervous about the influence of the South in American politics, thought about the institution of slavery as this kind of original sin, this sort of ancient evil that had kind of twined itself serpent-like around the vitals of the American Republic. And Lincoln, certainly by the time of the Civil War and during the Civil War, saw it in those terms. The other thing I think that's very interesting about the way in which Vampire Hunter makes this correlation between Southern slavery, Southern plantation owners, the Confederacy itself, with vampires, and the idea that slaves were not only being used for labor but were being used for food, is that actually resonates in some interesting ways with a lot of 19th century slave folklore about what slavery meant. If we go all the way back to the beginnings of the African slave trade, you have stories that circulated in West Africa, up and down the Gambia River, about the white slavers as cannibals. Stories that I came across in Louisiana, actually vampire stories, of slaves who were convinced that their masters were drinking the blood of their fellow enslaved people. And so, you know, one thing that I would say in response to those who might have some nervousness about what this does to sort of the historicity of slavery, the historicity of the Civil War, is that it's not a new thing to tell monster stories about significant events in American culture. Seth Graham Smith wasn't the first to do it. He just did a really good job of it. And blended, you know, very real primary sources in with the telling of that story.
So the Rotten Tomatoes summarization of, you know, a bunch of critic complaints about this movie is that
right.
the movie's overly serious tone doesn't jive
yes.
with its decidedly silly central premise. But
right.
whether or not it's a good film, that's certainly arguable.
Right.
You've argued,
and let me just say, I saw it on Saturday, and I can sort of definitively say it's not a very good, not a very good film. You know, for those who are interested in this, I you know, it's one of those things that you need to go to the book, and maybe skip the movie.
And the book's premise shouldn't just be dismissed as a simple joke.
Absolutely not. Now, I think that it comes across as a bit more of a joke in the film. That was actually, you know, sort of one of my problems with it. The fact of the matter is, Seth Graham Smith's writing in the novel is so layered, does take the history so seriously, does take individuals like Stephen Douglas so seriously, and sort of entangles him in the story in an interesting way. And that just doesn't come out in the film. One of my real disappointments actually with the movie is that we sort of skip over a lot of what happens in the novel in the 1840s and 1850s, which is kind of all about the politics of Lincoln's rise to eventually become the Republican nominee in 1860. And that really sort of takes this metaphor about slavery as a danger to democracy, slavery as a great evil, and really blends that, I think, very well with the political situation in the 1850s.
The email from Jeff in Salt Lake City. He writes, I read an article recently that had analyzed the popularity of zombie and vampire movies and had found that vampires are typically more popular when a liberal president is in office, and zombie movies are more popular when a conservative president is in office. Do the monster movies that we prefer mirror the political fears of a given time, Scott Poole?
I think to some degree. I don't think quite that neatly. You know, for one thing, I think that, you know, zombie films have been particularly popular just here in the last few years. I would say that, you know, one thing about the zombie film is that much more than the vampire genre, it taps into our fears of apocalypse. I mean, zombies never come by themselves. They always bring an apocalypse with them. They are not just stories about monsters. They're stories about a situation of complete and utter social breakdown. And I think it is true. I think part of the explanation for the popularity of zombies over the last few decades has been this kind of apocalyptic sense in American culture. I mean, we've become fascinated with apocalypses, plural, of all kinds, whether that's Mayan or atomic or the fear of Y2K in 1999. And these are really ways to talk to ourselves about the possibility of social breakdown. And I think also ways to ask ourselves questions about, you know, who do we become when the cable's out and the wireless is down and the air conditioning's off, and as it is for a lot of people in the country right now, but forever, when sort of all of that is taken away from us. And so, you know, as many listeners know, zombie films are less about zombies than they are about survivors. What do they do? How do they form new communities once all these supports that we think are so important to us are gone?
When Richard Matheson wrote I Am Legend in 1954, mm-hmm. it was set against a vampire-led apocalypse.
But yes.
By the time it's recreated in film in 2007, it's a zombie flick. And is that a
right.
stylistic decision, or do you think it says something about what Americans had come to expect from each type of monster in the intervening years?
I think it's partially stylistic. I think it partially was George Romero wanting to get away a little bit from the I Am Legend idea of, the protagonist is safe to kind of move around in the daytime, but not at night, as you would be with vampires. He wanted to create this really out-of-control situation in which you were kind of, not safe at any time. I would say that, the vampire apocalypse idea has made a little bit of a comeback. And in fact, all the way back in the 70s, it did. Salem's Lot, the Stephen King novel, later a couple of film versions of it, was a bit of a mini-apocalypse, a mini-vampire apocalypse story. There's actually a really interesting independent film made in the last couple of years called Stakeland that I would actually encourage viewers to take listeners to take a look at that kind of dealt a bit with that idea. I think it also shows just, this idea of these evil twins, the fact that vampires and zombies really do bear a family relationship to one another and are touching on some of the same fears.
Scott, real briefly, what are you working on now? I hear a new book about Vampira.
Yes, I'm working on Vampira or Vampyra. For listeners who don't know her, and I think she's become increasingly well-known in the last 10 years or so, Vampira was really the original horror host in way, way back on Los Angeles TV in 1954. And I'm writing about her. I'm writing about the person behind Vampira, who was a Finnish immigrant by the name of Mela Nurmi.
Fantastic.
So going back to the 1950s.
Scott Poole, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Our executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. And I'm Matthew LaPlante.